It's been nearly half a century since the sport of surfing became part of popular culture.
From the Banzai Pipeline to Waimea Bay, the big surf daddy of them all, there's wave after wave of wild excitement. With the guys who go where the action is, and the gals who go for the action guys.
From the Hollywood movies of the 50s and 60s to today, surfing has become a multi-billion-dollar industry enjoyed by an estimated 4 million surfers each year. But that's modern history. As part of the series, present at the creation, NPR's Tom Goldman reports on the roots of surfing.
It would be a stretch to call this early surf music. Still, this 1920s recording of the traditional Hawaiian nose flute gets us close. It's the music of ancient Hawaii, and that's where surfing developed, as a sport and a way of life connected even to the religion of the islands. Sitting near the shore on the island of Oahu, Hawaiian minister Butch Halemano chants an ancient surfing prayer. It's a blessing he regularly gives before major surfing competitions.
Our traditional beliefs are that we were created from and came from the ocean, not only from a spiritual sense, but from a physical sense. So going into the ocean, into the kai, as we call it, is basically a spiritual experience for Native Hawaiian.
And it was great fun, hundreds of years ago, for everyone.
From a small child who can just barely walk, coming out of the hale or the home, to the eldest elemakuli or the eldest person who walked with a ko'oko or a cane, all these people surfed in the ancient Hawaiian culture. When the Europeans first arrived here, they made comments in some of their diaries and some of their logs on their ship's logs, how when they would go to a village, it would be completely empty, and they feared there was disease when, in fact, the waves were up, and the whole village was down surfing at their nearest favorite surf spot.
Historians believe Polynesians began riding waves as far back as 2000 BC and brought the sport with them when they migrated to the Hawaiian Islands around 400 AD. The first European account of Hawaiian surfing appeared in 1779. It was written by a shipmate of Captain James Cook, the British explorer who first landed in the Hawaiian Islands.
The wave sends them in with most astonishing velocity. And the great art is to guide the plank so as to always keep it in a proper direction to the top of the swell. The natives seem to feel a great pleasure in the motion which this exercise gives.
Pre-Hawaiian surfers often lay down or knelt on their boards. Hawaiians perfected the art of standing up, as they took advantage of a couple of important factors. Hawaii's geography created better and bigger waves than other Pacific islands, and Hawaii had tall, sturdy trees that could be made into longer and wider boards.
This is a board that is over 17 feet long.
Betty Cam works at the Bishop Museum in Honolulu, where nearly two dozen historic surfboards are stacked horizontally in a storage room.
The board came to us from the estate of a princess, and this princess was actually associated with the Kalakaua family and the Liliuokalani family. Those are the last two monarchs in the Hawaiian government.
This mahogany-colored board is an olo, the biggest of the original surfboards. Olos could stretch to 24 feet and weigh over 200 pounds. Randy Rarick, a longtime surfboard builder on Oahu's North Shore, says olo surfers often needed help.
And a lot of times they would actually take a canoe and they'd have the olo right next to the canoe, and they'd get up to speed, and then the surfer would jump on the board, and because they could get going faster with the canoe paddles.
Only the elite got this special treatment, because while surfing was for every man and woman in Hawaii, it was strictly divided by social rank. The olos were reserved for the ruling class, while commoners surfed mainly on a smaller board called an alaia. The so-called Sport of Kings also had strict rules as to where people surfed. If commoners strayed into a royalty-only area of waves and beach, they'd risk beatings, even death. The sport itself almost died out in the 1800s as European missionaries cracked down on many Hawaiian traditions. It wasn't until the 20th century that people like Duke Kahanamoku started to bring surfing back. Duke, a native Hawaiian, became known as the father of modern surfing. He gave exhibitions and spread the sport throughout the world. Surfing's most unlikely ambassador turned out to be a scrawny, ponytailed California girl with a desperate desire to ride the waves.
Well, you see, what I need the money for is a surfboard.
A surfboard?
A surfboard. I mean, I'm a perfectly good swimmer and jabby, extra super careful. Oh, please.
The 1959 movie Gidget helped turn the once moribund sport into a craze.
Now, honest, surfing is out of this world. You just can't imagine the thrill of shooting the curl. Well, it positively surpasses every living emotion I've ever had.
You must admit, dear, she does make it sound attractive.
Surf culture exploded in the U.S. in the late 50s as Gidget led the wave of beach movies and books. The cascading guitar work of Dick Dale helped provide the soundtrack to modern surfing. And for those who got hooked on the idea of surfing, suddenly it became easier to get out on the water and actually do it. The Hobie Surfboard Factory in Capistrano Beach, California, bears the name of another surf pioneer. But Hobie Alter wasn't known for riding the waves, rather for making sure anyone who wanted to ride could. In 1958, Alter and his partner Gordon Clark developed boards with a polyurethane foam core, light years ahead of the wooden behemoths of old Hawaii. The new boards were lighter, more maneuverable, and much easier to shape. Mark Johnson, the general manager at Hobie's, says foam revolutionized the custom surfboard market.
They could shape boards for different sizes, different weights of people. Also, probably the most importantly, different places that they surf, because you have a board with a far different design that you're riding in Hawaii versus that you're riding here in California. So it basically made limitless possibilities of design.
Surfboard design has continued. In 1980, a surfer from Australia added two more fins to the one fin that had been a standard for so long. The three-fin thruster, with its extra maneuverability, has been the board of choice for the past 20 years. While surfboards have changed so much since ancient times, and the professional circuit has made a few talented and lucky surfers quite rich, much about surfing has not changed. The ancient Hawaiians would drop everything to ride the good waves. That attitude continues, especially with lifers like California surfing legend Mickey Munoz.
I'm ready to ride at any moment. I've just made my life so I could do that.
One might say Munoz would wear anything to ride a wave. His friends still chuckle at the sight of him in a bikini and wig as a stunt double for Gidget in the movie. His playful and somewhat mystical approach to surfing also mirrors the old Hawaiians. Listen as he describes riding a special wave several years ago, a 12-footer that curled over and surrounded him in a translucent tunnel of water.
I came out of this thing and survived it. I had a grin from ear to ear, and it was as if I had exceeded the speed of light. So I'm absolutely convinced I came out younger. I was able to beat time.
Mickey Munoz turns 65 next month. If he keeps surfing and peeling back time, he might just be the ultimate link, perhaps an actual witness to the origins of the sport. Tom Goldman, NPR News.